I'm very pleased to welcome back to View from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome back, Martin. Are you in the west, the east, the north?
No, I'm in the Harbour City at the moment, Michael. I'm in Sydney and enjoying the nice weather here. It's balmy, but the in-between weather. So it's been quite nice.
Well, if you're in the Harbour City, I imagine you will have been one of the first to catch former Prime Minister Tony Abbott's latest contribution to the public policy debate, in this case, the Iran war debate. He wrote an opinion piece in the Daily Telegraph today asking why the nation has armed forces if they won't be used. He said, and I quote, "What is the point of having armed forces if they're not to be used to support our allies in a just cause? And what could be a more just cause than the US-Israeli bid to deny Iran nuclear weapons, uphold freedom of navigation in the Hormuz Straits, and, if possible, liberate Iran from a monstrous theocracy?" I close the quote. Seemed a very strange late input into the debate. What do you make of that, Martin?
The timing is very strange because we've had a ceasefire declared at the moment. Now, we'll talk about whether that's actually happening, but never mind. That's that timing. And then the other thing is, this idea that you have to use your defense forces. I would have thought most major leaders would be using their defense forces as a last resort, not just because they have them. So it was a. Wasn't it's an odd logic. The other thing is, if you think about some of those strategic games he's talking about, like changing the regime, even the Trump government has stepped back from that at the moment, not using that rhetoric. Well, so yeah, it was an interesting intervention, and the timing was a bit strange for me.
Well, Martin, let's come to the so-called ceasefire. As you know, I've doubted from the very beginning of this conflict over Iran that it was going to be resolved as the President Trump suggested it would in the first instance in 2 or 3 days. I've always thought it was going to drag on. And eventually we've got this so-called ceasefire. I'm not convinced myself that it is. I'm just looking at some of the headlines as we meet in the morning in Fremantle. The Guardian has a main headline dealing with the Middle East crisis live that Netanyahu says, quote unquote, "No ceasefire in Lebanon." Air raid sirens across Israel as Hezbollah launches rockets. And then, of course, in Pakistan, in Islamabad, they're getting ready to play host for the negotiations between Iran and the US and the vice president. Apparently is going to turn up. And I'm not sure. I think Marco Rubio, you'd expect that he'd be there as well. And it's all getting warmer. Martin, that's what happens if you look at the headlines on The Guardian. If you go to the BBC website, which I always find very well informed, their live heading says Trump says Iran's handling of ships in Strait of Hormuz is not the agreement we have. He doesn't want them charging fees to oil tankers going through, and he says they'd better not be. And the question still is, ceasefire or no ceasefire, the Middle East's reshuffling is not yet done. I mean, what does it mean in this case to say we've got a ceasefire? What does the ceasefire, do you think, look like?
Well, you've peeled off a range of problems here. I think at best you might call the current situation a de-escalation in the warfare and in the actual conflict. You certainly can't call it any kind of complete ceasefire. I think probably you could say at the heart of the problem is significant disagreement around Lebanon. Now, this is a big deal because Iran has supported Hezbollah in Lebanon. And Iraq and Israel is attacking them, and of course, Hezbollah is fighting back and throwing missiles and the like. That's another theater of this war. So you can't really shut down a war and have another theater just running along. So the Israel, US is saying it wasn't in the deal. Iran is saying it wasn't a deal. It was, and then you had the Pakistani Prime Minister who cut the deal, apparently saying it was in the deal. So that's a mess. That's a mess. So, you've got Israel firing on Lebanon at the moment. You've got Kuwait saying that Iran was firing upon them. You've got very few ships actually passing through that strait at the moment. You've got Vance kind of saying, well, Lebanon wasn't in there, but they've offered to check themselves a little bit in Lebanon, whatever that means. That's Vice President Vance saying that about Israel. Again, there's utter confusion. And one of the problems with all of these things that Trump's involved in is there doesn't seem to be strategic clarity around what you're actually doing. So you would have thought you have a ceasefire, which for at least for the short term, might be 1 week, might be 2 weeks. This one's 2 weeks, is a total cessation of hostility so you can actually get something done. It doesn't appear to be the case at all. Interestingly, there was some discussion around talks between the Lebanese government and Israel, but the Lebanese government, as we all know, doesn't control Hezbollah. And without that being folded into the broader ceasefire, I'm not sure about how successful that would be.
Well, Martin, everyone's trying to work out if there is some sort of, let's not call it peace, as you say, de-escalation of things, and people can sort of get on with their lives, sort of what the world actually looks like. I mean, one really interesting story on the New York Times just now is headed "Iran's Battered Leaders Emerge from War Confident and with New Cards." And this is written by Yegane Torbati and Erica Solomon, Torbati being a Times reporter, I think in or certainly on the Iranian sort of policy front. And they start out saying that their supreme leader and top commanders were killed. Military bases, factories and bridges were reduced to rubble. Their economy has taken blow after blow. Yet Iran's authoritarian rulers believe they have emerged from this war in a stronger position than when it began. And they're not in any conciliatory frame of mind, are they?
I would point out that they have been really, this is battered there. They've had their military severely depleted, probably some of the nuclear sites bombed again and obliterated. So I don't think it's all plain sailing for Iran, but you're right about them probably having just as firm a grip, maybe firmer than they had previously at the start of the war. The other problem is this Straits of Hormuz that wasn't actually an issue before the war. That could be an issue now. Iran's talking about charging ships to go through the strait. I mean, that would be disastrous for global shipping. So maybe a best case scenario for the US is that they go back to a pre-war state where that shipping lane is free. And the thing about the depletion of your armed forces, over a period of years, you just build that up again. So, I mean, it's hard to find, really comprehensive strategic objectives which have been achieved here.
Well, I mean, everybody's looking at it from every which way. If you're an ordinary, not overly concerned with politics, Iranian trying to run your shop or pull people's teeth out, if you're a dentist or, just wanting to go on the weekend up skiing into the mountains, and would you hang around? I think some people are starting to predict there's going to be a new wave of emigration, which means the people who stay behind are more likely to be attuned to the current government, Martin, and it's not suddenly going to become a democratic republic.
Yeah, I think this is the problem with the regime change argument, and that's that what we've seen is that that current regime is deeply embedded. It's not reliant on one to two leaders or even a dozen leaders. The US and Israel have assassinated multiple leaders time and again, and new ones just sprout up. And if there were moderates who were keen on a rapprochement with the West, they're probably being sidelined at the moment.
Well, Martin, all of these foundations around the world that study peace or war or democracies or whatever are all well and truly pulling their thinking caps on. The senior director of the Iran program at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, Ben Taleblou, has said this: all of the issues that separated the US and Iran have only grown harder to resolve through compromise. Another round of fighting sooner or later is therefore likely to come. It's not what you'd actually call the ringing endorsement that Trump would have been looking for. They're just going to have to leave their troops there, aren't they? They're going to have the aircraft carrier sitting there. They're going to have missiles in the Gulf states pointing just over the Gulf of Straits of Hormuz to somehow try and maintain international shipping.
Well, they could try and cut a deal where Iran agrees to have free and uninhibited shipping. But the thing is, what will Iran want from that? What's US going to have to put on the table to achieve that? That's what I mean about best case scenario being what we had beforehand, and I'm not even sure we'll get there.
I mean, I don't think anyone actually knows what the so-called 10-point plan is. There was something that Trump was putting around. Then there was a document that we all read that the Iranians put out, which seemed like a complete and utter capitulation by the US, including paying reparation to Iran for all the trouble they've caused. And then Trump said, "Oh no, we've got our own document and we don't agree with theirs. We haven't agreed to anything." So just what they're going to be using as an agenda to talk about some sort of resolution, I don't know. We'll hear more about it. But Martin, you wouldn't want to be NATO just at the moment, would you? I mean, they must be sitting down trying to work out what they're going to look like, how soon they formally expel the US, or put it another way, how soon the US actually withdraws from NATO. And there's another headline in the New York Times which says NATO labours to avoid becoming another casualty of the war in Iran. But can it? It's all over, isn't it?
I'm not entirely sure about that because the thing about Trump is you don't just go on what he says, you go on what he does. You know, his rhetoric and reality are not always the same thing. He still entertained the Secretary General of NATO just this week, who he does appear to have some sort of working relationship with. So I think it's sort of bluster and, you know, rhetoric to try to deflect his ultimate responsibility for this conflict. More than anything else, you know, he started the war. He's been commander in chief the whole time, and so the blaming of his allies is just par for the course. And even Australia, I don't actually take much stock on his rhetoric towards Australia. So I know that some of our media outlets get in a apoplectic sort of frenzy whenever Trump opens his mouth about Australia, but there's very few allies that he hasn't bashed. There's Japan. There's South Korea. There's Australia. I mean, Japan and South Korea, Michael, are massive strategic allies for the US in the Asia Pacific. Though it would be disastrous for the US to walk away from them because they're your forward defense. That's your forward allies in a what's a really turbulent area. If a US walked away from all the allies that Trump had been potting, it would have no influence globally or greatly reduced influence globally. So I think there's the rhetoric and then there's reality.
And at the same time, we've got the Israeli war cabinet under Netanyahu going on doing what they've always wanted to do. Have this opportunity not only to try and wipe out or change the regime in Tehran, but to make sure they've removed every missile launcher that's anywhere near them. They've already done that to Gaza pretty much. Now they're in Lebanon trying to do that. And we've had around about 300 people killed just in the last very short while. And this is happening. Well, Donald Trump says he's asked Netanyahu to be more low key in Lebanon. I mean, what does that mean? Does that mean that Trump has absolutely no control over Netanyahu and the Israeli war cabinet?
Yeah, I think this is actually a real problem for Trump, and that's that he's got his aims and goals and what he needs to do, and he's got American public opinion. But the one key ally that he appears to be working with has got their own completely separate agenda. And for Netanyahu, he's not really interested in peace with Iran. Iran and Israel have been at each other's throats for a better part of 2 decades, 2 to 3 decades. And they both regard each other as an existential threat. Iran is weakened militarily, and Netanyahu wants to keep fighting, basically. So one of the first problems that Trump has to do is rein in his own key ally. and make him agree to any peace agreement.
Well, Martin, we all know that some ships have been getting through the Straits of Hormuz, and we know that for quite a while diplomatic efforts across the world were focused on doing that, so the world economy didn't sort of collapse and our economy didn't keep experiencing the inflation that it has. And it seems that in recent times only 11 ships, four Iranian, four Greek, one Chinese, one Omani, and one unknown one were allowed to pass through the strait in the 24 hours after the ceasefire was announced, less than a tenth of the pre-war flow, that is. It raises an interesting question, though, when you see China mentioned in all of this. One also reads that China have quietly in the, not so much in the background, but in the background, been encouraging Iran to take stock and to open the Straits of Hormuz and to make this agreement. I mean, where does China fit in this? We keep coming back to China, but there are those analysts who believe that Trump did all of the Iran attacking to keep China out, and that's what the real subtext was, and that most of us have missed the point that Iran is really all about China. Do you buy that?
I'm not convinced. I do understand what they're saying, and I think that there's an interesting geostrategic argument. I think that if Trump was your conventional actor, there might be a stronger argument because what you do in the Middle East does impact on China. The thing about Trump is not necessarily a long-term thinker. There's no evidence of this, of anything else that he's done in tariffs or anything else. He tends to respond to a lot of events in front of him. And you can see that with his rhetoric and all of the things that he conveys. The sort of prevent China thesis in Iran, it does presume a level of longer term strategic thinking around China, around Trump there. And if that was the case, he would probably be more sanguine, wouldn't he? And more, consistent with a lot of his approach. That's not to say that there isn't some really substantial impact on China in Iran with the conflict. And it's not to say there aren't any outcomes that hang on this. Clearly, Iran and China are close. China does get quite a bit of its oil supplies from Iran. What we do know about China, though, Michael, we see this with mineral resources in Australia. China diversifies its supply chain. It has a lot of long-term strategic planning. So even though it relies on our iron ore, for instance, it's got a lot of other supply chains from South America and other places. So they've been diversifying. The other thing China's been doing is electrifying. They've spent a lot of time electrifying. They're miles ahead of many other parts of the world in terms of their transport in that area. So yes, they're impacted, but China, you're not going to bring down China by bringing down Iran.
Well, if you're talking about influence in the world, there's no doubt China. It's been coming ever since I was a boy. We've all just been waiting and watching, and it's been happening. And their influence in the world, which if Trump was trying to cause it to flatten out a little, is going to be greater than ever, isn't it, after
Yeah,
this?
well, I mean, this is the curious thing, right? If you're trying to reduce Chinese influence, you probably need to actually affect regime change in Iran, if that was the purpose of this Iranian war, because leaving that regime intact probably just makes them lean on China more, China and Russia more, and leaving that regime intact means that China will continue medium to long term to get that oil, and so it's. I think China actually comes out of this conflict pretty well. It's interesting, Trump's railing against a lot of people. The one group of people has not really railed against is China and Russia. Now, interestingly, it's almost certain, Michael, that Iran is relying on Russian intelligence in this war significantly. And when Trump was questioned directly on this, he said, "Oh, well, we expect them to probably help out Iran a bit because we're helping out Ukraine a bit." So after railing against your allies, Michael, he was a bit, "Oh, well, that's what you expect Russia to do."
Martin, this is as far back as I can think. I think perhaps to the times when Australia was involved with the United States in the war in Vietnam is the biggest, most momentous sort of recalibration of the world order that we've seen. More so, I don't think since the Cold War days have we seen anything that's as worrying as this. I mean, there's the whole question of what's going to happen with the NATO alliance. There's a question of, as you say, what happens with China's continuing flexing of their economic muscle and increasingly their military one. But the Russians are plainly, Putin is plainly keen to get back the old USSR. No one's going to trust. We Australians aren't going to trust the US government in the way we used to, are we? You can't assume that suddenly if Trump loses office that it's going to reflect to some good old days as if it were under Dwight Eisenhower or the like.
This is the challenge. If you let's say Trump, Trump terms finishes, let's say you have your more conventional president that's succeeding, Michael. The problem that's still there is, for decades, US has been a trustworthy ally for for NATO members in particular, and then a range of other members elsewhere. What does the Trump presidency show when you've got a president a future president in office that focuses solely on his own interests and that maybe that of America, to be fair? They're not the same global citizen that they were. So it is going to ask tough questions of other countries around the world. What we're already seeing from those European countries is a very significant increase in defense spending. That's significant. And we're not seeing any interest in Russia or China around a rapprochement with the West. Why would they? Again, if America's inconsistent there. So we are looking at a fracturing of a lot of conventional alliances and global posturing.
Well, the other thing I can't get my head around is why Trump, on the face of it, is not really relying on what you'd call the professional diplomats to help work all of these problems through. In the major meetings, both in Moscow, in the Ukraine, recently in Jerusalem, and also with the Iranians before this war broke out, you have Steve Witkoff, his envoy going here and there. He's another property developer, and Jared, the son-in-law, gets to tag along. And you say, what's going on here? Do they speak Iranian? Have they got PhDs in how you deal with Iran over the centuries? Do you understand them as negotiating partners? Do you have these people in the back room? Do you bring them into the front room? The Iranian specialists. Who understand all of these things? I'm sort of dumbfounded. Is this just Trump thinking, we know everything, we can deal with it? It's just another real estate deal.
The interesting guy, I think, when it comes to the negotiations, Michael, is the Vice President Vance. Apparently, we've got more reports coming through this week with more details. Apparently, if the one senior official in Trump's circle who said this war with Iran is a really bad idea, don't do it. And yet he's the guy that's leading, now going to lead the negotiations. So maybe he can present a posture that's more conciliatory and more consistent, appears to probably put something on the table that the Iranians can accept. So I think what he's saying in public, because he's been behind Trump in public, and what he's saying behind closed doors are quite different. And when we had the ceasefire just announced and the Lebanon issue, he described it as a legitimate misunderstanding. So he's trying to walk a bit of a fine line ahead of these negotiations. He's got a big task ahead of him to, bridge this gulf in understanding and agenda between those two sides. So a lot's going to hang on his competency and whether he can actually achieve that.
Well, Martin, let's bring this lively discussion to a close, but let's do so by trying to identify what we think are going to be the not the key sticking points, but the major issues upon which they're going to have to come to some agreement about in Islamabad in order to continue the 2-week ceasefire into something more substantive. What would you start What would you start with? I'll throw Israel into it. Israel have to stop continuing to bomb Lebanon, don't they?
Yeah, so you're going to need to seek a commitment to a complete cessation of hostilities. So Israel has to agree to not bomb Lebanon at all. Of course, Hezbollah has to agree to not attack Israel, but I suspect they will as part of the Iranian negotiations. There'll have to be a complete agreement by all sides to stop attacking one another as well. There has to be a complete ceasefire. Iran would have to agree to open the straits. But again, what is Iran going to want in return? Probably that means the US is going to have to agree to not attack Iran or its proxies for at least a defined period of time around that. The other thing that's clearly on Iran's radar that the US can't legitimately openly agree to is some form of reparations or compensation for hitting many thousands of their sites. What US could do with that is agree to fund production projects, oil and other infrastructure production projects in the Middle East that would include Iran and the Gulf states and other places. So they're throwing money at Iran, but not openly as part of reparations. The thing about that might be attractive for the US is if they could get a cut of the action. I mean, Trump always wants a business deal, doesn't he? So if he agreed to throw billions of dollars at Iran, but in return get something financially out of it, that might be attractive for him. But I mean, these are big hurdles to jump, really.
Big thing, of course, that on the face of it, and the Tony Abbotts of the world would agree with this as well, is you don't want Iran becoming the world power that's nuclear armed. So you want a cessation in the production of armaments, or at
Yes.
least certain types of long range missiles, and you want, if you're going to be using nuclear materials, for them only to be used for domestic power purposes. You don't want them building nuclear warheads. So I guess those two issues need to be, will have to be on the agenda from a US, Israel, and the broader Western community point of view.
Yes, you're right about the nuclear aspirations. But usually, Iran's nuclear aspirations have been surreptitious anyway. So then again, what happens if they start doing a few things under the surface and then there's bombings and I don't know. It's very hard to see this working at the moment. I mean, it might get some breakthroughs. There's probably if there's a lot of money in it for Iran, that might be helpful, Michael. They know that their infrastructure is depleted at the moment. So that might be helpful. Of course, the other thing is Israel doesn't really want the US and Iran to get along. So any kind of deal between them would make the Israel uncomfortable anyway, wouldn't it?
It would. And I suppose if you're negotiating someone, probably the Iranians would say, look, we're happy to, we don't have great nuclear warhead dreams. So do you want to put in a UN inspector to make sure we're not doing anything untoward? Iran would probably propose that because UN inspectors seem to be hopeless at their job.
They don't tend to do much, and I don't know if Donald Trump has a lot of time for the UN generally.
So between them, yes, it'd be a totally ineffectual step. Do you feel it in your bones at this point? We have to be Trumpian here, don't we? We're relying on instinct. Do you think they're going to work something out, Martin? Imperfect as it might be, and short-lived as it might be in terms of a year or two.
They could do something like we saw with Israel and Gaza, where there's some kind of plan in, put in place that's, well, at least announced that appears to give some succor to both sides. And of course, what we know has happened since that time is that Israel and Gaza, that plan has never really been enacted. And it's just it's a frozen conflict, you might say, between Israel and Gaza at the moment, Israel and Hamas. This could be a bit similar, where but it's a get out of jail card for Trump. See, this is the problem with Trump. He announces things, and where's the follow through? Could you see that board of peace, board of peace for Gaza or something ever doing anything?
No, and you're right to raise it. I reckon the Board of Peace will suddenly be given a fresh mandate to take in Iran and its rebuilding.
It might well be the case, absolutely. Because remember, he painted that picture of the Riviera of the Middle East for Gaza. He might do something like that with Iran. You know, oh, we'll, Iran, we're going to, you know, with Iran and US, they're going to turn Iran into some Riviera. But nothing happens, Michael.
Well, perhaps the most outlandish picture we can paint, Martin, is one of President Trump flying into Tehran, standing side by side with the new Ayatollah, the son of the old Ayatollah Khomeini, and a new nomination by the Nobel Peace Board itself for Trump to win the 2026 Nobel Peace Prize. Am I just being silly?
Oh, look, we live in a very zany, crazy world, Michael. You know, and when I saw that clip, if you remember, about that Trump put out with I think it was a him and Netanyahu on a sun chair or something, looking at the beautiful Gaza. It was, and everyone said how bad a taste it was, mind you. I mean, many thousands of Gazans have died in that conflict, but nothing surprises me anymore.
Well, Martin, I think all we can do is watch, study closely, and try and understand what they do in Islamabad over the next few days. What is interesting is that the Pakistanis are doing it. They seem to have some trust from DC, and they seem to have the trust of the government in Tehran. That's not an entire surprise, I suppose.
And behind the scenes, we're told China might have been at play as well, Michael.
Yes.
So China as a client for Iran's oil and one of those people that's still trading a lot with them, etc., they would have a fair bit of leverage here, and they would be interested in peace, you would have thought.
Martin, thanks for joining me today. It's been interesting. I think our listeners will detect sort of just a hint of not optimism, but hope. But we've seen it all dashed before. Let's hope something good comes out of it all.
Well, at least if there's a de-escalation of conflict, that's better than what we had before. But we do hope that something lasting.
The seventh beatitude for those who read the Christian Bible, Martin, is blessed be the peacemakers.
Indeed. I think that's still a valid phrase, really relevant phrase today.
See you next week, Martin.
Pleasure.